friends and disgusted our group and walked away. Other groups were purchased, loaded into wagons and driven off through the valley to disappear through the V at the base of the hills. We finished the last drops of slop and water, debating whether we wanted to be bought. Someone mentioned escaping. Running away was briefly discussed until a gunshot rang out, followed by screams near the front of the train. The little girl with the dolly began to cry. "Elena," said Mrs. Rimmis, "ask one of the guards where they're taking the people." Mother tried to speak with a guard, but he ignored her. For the moment, I didn't care what happened. The grass smelled like fresh chives, and the sunshine filled me with strength. I stood up and stretched. The children spread out a bit, and the guards didn't seem to care. The NKVD inspected the train cars, stopping only to scream that we were filthy pigs who disrespected the train. The engine hissed, readying for departure. "They're going back for more," said Andrus. "You think so?" asked Jonas. "They won't stop," said Andrus, "until they've gotten rid of all of us." Chapter 24. Hours passed and the sun began to sink. Only two groups remained. The grouchy woman stomped around and yelled at us. She said Mother made our group appear weak and that now they would probably shoot everyone. "Let them shoot us," said the bald man. "I'm telling you, we'd be better off." "But they were going to make us slaves," argued Mrs. Arvidus. "A little work wouldn't kill you," said the grouchy woman to Mrs. Arvidus. "They'll probably want some manual labor from us, that's all. That's why they took the other groups first, because most of you look so weak. I grew up on a farm. I'm not afraid to get my hands dirty." "Then you're elected to go dig up some food," said Andrus. "Now leave our mothers alone." Jonas and I were spread out on the grass, trying to stretch our stiff muscles. Andrus joined us, put his hands behind his head, and stared up at the sky. "Your forehead is getting red," I told him.
"A sunburn is the least of my worries," said Andrus. "I'm not turning my back to the guards. Maybe if we get a bit of color, we'll be bought and hauled off into Soviet slavery like the witch wants," he said.
Jonas rolled over onto his back like Andrus. "Just as long as we can stay together. Papa said that's important."
"I have no choice but to stay with my mother. I'm surprised she made it this far," said Andrus, looking over in her direction.
Mrs. Arvidus was swatting flies away with her silk handkerchief and losing her balance in the process.
"She's not exactly hardy."
"Do you have any sisters or brothers?" asked Jonas.
"No," said Andrus. "My mother didn't enjoy being pregnant. My father said that since he had a son, he didn't need any more children."
"My papa said they're going to give us another brother or sister one day. I think I'd like a brother," said Jonas. "So what do you think everyone at home is doing? Do you think they wonder what happened to us?"
"If they do, they're too scared to ask about it," said Andrus.
"But why? And why were we sent away?" asked Jonas.
"Because we were on the list," I said.
"But why were we on the list?" continued Jonas.
"Because Papa works at the university," I replied.
"But Mrs. Raskunas works at the university, and she wasn't taken," said Jonas. Jonas was right. Mrs. Raskunas had peered out from behind her curtains as we were being hauled off in the night. I had seen her staring. Why wasn't her family taken? Why did they hide behind their curtains instead of trying to stop them from deporting us? Papa would never have done that.
"I can understand why the bald man is on the list," I said. "He's horrible." "He's awfully eager to die, isn't he?" said Andrus, staring up at the sky.
"You know what?" said Jonas. "Looking at the sky, it's like I'm lying on the grass at home in Lithuania."
That sounded like something Mother would say, throwing color onto a black and white picture.
"Look," continued Jonas. "That cloud looks like a cannon."
"Make it blow up the Soviets," I said, running my fingers over the blades of grass. "They deserve it."
Andrus turned his head to me. I felt awkward under his prolonged gaze.
What? I asked. You always seem to have a mouthful of opinions, he said.
That's what Papa said. See, Lina, you better be careful, said Jonas. My bedroom door swung open.
Lina, I want to see you in the living room, said Papa.
Why? I asked.
In the living room, now! Papa's nostrils flared.
He walked out of the room. Mother, what's wrong? You heard your father, Lina. Go to the living room. We walked out into the hallway.
Go to sleep, Jonas, said Mother, without even looking in the direction of my brother's room.
I looked over. Jonas was peeking out his bedroom door, his eyes wide. Papa was steaming mad, and he was mad at me. What had I done? I walked into the living room.
Is this what you waste your talent on?
He thrust a scrap of paper in my face. Papa, it was a joke, I explained.
You think it's a joke. What if the Kremlin doesn't think it's a joke? They're perfect likenesses, for God's sake.
He dropped the paper into my lap. I looked at my sketch. The likeness was perfect. Even in a clown suit, it was obviously Stalin. I drew him standing in our dining room, with Papa and his friends sitting around the table, launching paper airplanes at him. The men were laughing. Stalin had a sad clown face as airplanes hit his head. Papa and Dr. Seltzer were perfect likenesses. I hadn't quite mastered the journalist's chin yet.
Are there others?
My father demanded, snapping the paper from me.
It was for fun,
said a small voice. Jonas stood in his pajamas in the hallway.
Please don't be mad, Papa.
Were you in on this too? Yelled my father.
Oh, Jonas, said Mother.
He wasn't in on it. I drew it myself. I showed it to him because I thought it was funny.
Have you shown this to anyone else?
Asked Papa.
No, I just drew it this afternoon, I said.
Lina, said Mother, this is serious. The Soviets could arrest you if they saw your drawing.
But how would they ever see it? I threw it away, I argued.
What if someone found it in the trash like I did? A wind could have blown this to the foot of Stalin, said Papa. You've drawn your father and his friends mocking the leader of the Soviet Union. Are there others?
He asked. No, that's the only one. Papa tore up my drawing and threw the pieces into the fire. Andrus continued to stare at me.
Is that what you want?
He finally asked.
To blow up the Soviets?
I turned to look at him. I just want to go home. I want to see my father, I said. He nodded. Chapter 25. Evening came, and two groups were left. Most of the NKVD had departed with the train. Only 5 armed officers remained with 2 trucks. Nearly 75 Lithuanians and only 5 Soviets, yet no one dared move. I think most of us were too tired and weak. The grass was a welcomed bed, the space a luxury. I made note of landmarks to draw for Papa. The NKVD made a fire and cooked their dinner while we sat and stared. They had American canned goods, bread, and coffee. After dinner, they drank vodka and smoked, the volume of their voices rising steadily. What are they saying? I asked Mother. They're talking about their homes, where they're from. They're sharing stories of their friends and family, she said.
I didn't believe her.
I listened to the Russian words. The tone of their voices and the cackling laughter didn't sound like talk of family. Ona began again. She had taken to chanting, no, 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 over and over. One of the NKVD stood up and yelled, flipping his hand at our group. I better try to quiet her, said Mother, getting up, before the guards become angry. Jonas was already asleep. I covered him with my blue raincoat and wiped his hair away from his eyes. The bald man snored. The gray-haired man wound his watch.
Andrus sat at the edge of the group, one knee pulled to his chest, watching the guards. He had a strong profile, an angular jaw. A piece of his disheveled hair fell perfectly against the side of his face. I'd need a soft pencil to draw it. He saw me staring. I turned away quickly. "Hey," he whispered to me. I looked up. Something rolled across the grass and hit my leg. It was the stone with the sparkles he had found that day when he jumped off the train. "The crown jewel from the train car princess," I whispered, smiling. He nodded with a laugh. I picked it up to roll back to him. "No, you keep it," said Andrus. We woke at sunrise. A few hours later, a wagon came, chose the other group and took them away. The guards then loaded us into the back of two trucks and drove us across the valley beyond the notch in the hills where a road began. No one spoke. We were too frightened to discuss our possible destination. Riding in the truck, I realized that trying to escape would have been ridiculous. There was nothing for miles. We didn't see a human being or pass another vehicle. I thought about the man who had my handkerchief, hoping it was passed along, moving closer to Papa. After 2 hours, we saw huts dotting the sides of the road. We entered what appeared to be an inhabited area, and the truck pulled over in front of a wooden building. The guards jumped out yelling, "Divai! Divai!" and other instructions. "They say we should leave our luggage in the trucks," said Mother, clutching her coat tightly over her arm. "I want to know where we're going before we get out," demanded Mrs. Arvidus. Mother tried to talk to the guards. She turned and smiled. "It's a bathhouse." We jumped off the truck. Mother folded her coat and put it in her suitcase. The guards split us into male and female groups. "Boys, carry me," the bald man said to Andrus and Jonas. "You have to bathe me." Jonas looked petrified, Andrus disgusted. I smiled, which seemed to annoy Andrus even more. The men went first. The guards called them up onto the porch and began yelling in their faces, pushing them. Jonas looked at Mother for translation. "Take off your clothes, dear," Mother translated. "Now? Right here?" Jonas asked, looking at all the women and girls. "We'll turn around, won't we, ladies?" said Mother. We all turned our backs to the porch.
"No use in being modest now," said Mr. Stallus. "We're nothing but skeletons. Now take off my pants, boy. Ow! Watch my leg!"
I heard Mr. Stallus complaining and Jonas apologizing. A belt buckle knocked against the wood of the porch. I wondered if it was Andrus's. The guards yelled. "He says you must leave your clothes there, that they will be deloused," Mother translated. Something smelled funny. I couldn't tell if it came from our group of women or from the bathhouse. We heard the bald man yell from within the structure. Mother turned around and clasped her hands together. "My sweet Jonas," she whispered. Chapter 26. We waited. "What's going on in there?" I said. Mother shook her head. Three NKVD stood on the porch. One barked yet another command. 10 of us at a time," said Mother. "We must go to the porch and take off our clothes." We were in the first group, along with Mrs. Arvidus, the grouchy woman, and her daughters. Mother helped Ona up onto the porch. I unbuttoned my dress and pulled it over my head, unbraided my hair and took off my sandals. Mother stood in her brassiere and underwear, helping Ona. The guards stood on the porch, staring at us. I hesitated. "It's okay, dear," said Mother. "Think of how nice it will be to feel clean again." Ona began to whimper. A young blonde guard lit a cigarette, turned his back, and looked off toward the truck. Another NKVD stared, grinning and biting his bottom lip. I took off my bra and panties and stood on the porch, covering myself with my hands. Mrs. Arvidus stood next to me, her voluptuous breasts too large to conceal with her thin forearm.
A guard with a gold tooth who appeared to be a commander walked down the porch, stopping to look at each woman, scanning her up and down. He stopped at Mrs. Arvidus. She did not lift her head. He swirled a toothpick on his tongue and raised his brow, violating her with his stare. I let out a breath in disgust. Mother's head snapped to me. The guard grabbed my arms and threw them down to my sides. He looked me up and down and grinned. He reached out and groped my breast. I felt his ragged fingernail scratch across my skin. I had never been naked in front of a man before. His touch, the rough hand on me, made me feel sick and dirtier on the inside than I was on the outside. I tried to cross my arms. Mother yelled something in Russian and pulled me behind Ona. Ona's inner thighs and buttocks were caked with chunks of dried blood. The guard began to scream at Mother. She removed her remaining clothing and put her arm around me. They marched us into the bathhouse. Chapter 27. A guard stood at a distance. He plunged a scoop in a bucket and threw some sort of white powder at us. The showers clicked on with an icy spray. "We must hurry," said Mother. "We don't know how long they'll give us." She took a small chunk of soap and scrubbed at my scalp and face, ignoring her own body. I watched the brown rivers of dirt run down my legs, over my ankles, and into the drain. I wanted to be sucked down with it, away from the guards and the humiliation. "Keep scrubbing, Lina, quickly," said Mother, turning to wash Ona. I stood shivering under the stream of water, washing as well as I could, hoping the guards would not be waiting for us on the other side of the wall. I washed Mother's back and tried to wash her hair. Mrs. Arvidus stood under the stream of water, her hands raised above her head gracefully, unaware, as if she were in her own private bath at home. The showers snapped off. We retrieved our clothes on the other side of the wall. I quickly pulled my dress over my head and felt a knock against my thigh. The stone from Andrus. I put my hand in my pocket, my fingers searching for the smooth edge. Mother combed through my hair with her fingers. I looked at her wet face. Water dripped from her blonde waves onto her shoulders. "I want to go home," I whispered, shivering. "Please." She dropped her clothing and hugged me, long and hard. "We'll go home. Keep thinking of your father and of our house. We must keep it alive in our hearts." She let go and looked at me. "If we do, we'll get there." The men were already in the first truck. Another group of women and children stood naked on the porch as we exited. "Feel better, darling?" said Mother, smiling at Jonas as she climbed into the truck. She checked her suitcase for her coat. Jonas looked much improved in appearance and disposition. So did Andrus. His wet hair was shiny, the color of dark cinnamon.
"Now we're clean dead men. So what of that?" said the bald man.
"If we were dead men, they wouldn't allow us to shower," said the gray-haired man, looking at his watch.
"Hey, there was blonde hair under all that dirt," said Andrus, reaching out and grabbing a strand of my hair. I shrank back and looked away. Mother put her arm around me.
"What's wrong, Lina?" asked Jonas.
I ignored him. I thought of the guard who touched me and all the things I should have done. Slapped him, kicked him, screamed in his face. I put my hand in my pocket and grabbed the stone from Andrus. I squeezed it and tried as hard as I could to break it. "Do you suppose they'll take us for a four-course meal now that we've been to the sauna?" joked Mrs. Rimmis. "Oh, yes, a piece of Black Forest tort and a cognac or two," laughed Mrs. Arvidus. "I'd love a nice hot coffee," said Mother.
"Strong coffee," added the bald man.
"Wow, I never thought it could feel so good to be clean," exclaimed Jonas, looking at his hands. Everyone's humor was much improved, except Ona's. She continued chanting, Despite the efforts of Mrs. Rimmis, she could not be calmed. As the last group of women and children boarded the truck, the commander saw Ona standing up, sitting down, and pulling her hair. He yelled at her. The young blonde guard appeared at the back of the truck. "Leave her be," said Mrs. Rimmis. "The poor dear is grieving." Mother translated to the commander. Ona stood up and stamped her right foot. The commander stepped up and pulled Ona from the truck. She lost all control, screaming, clawing at him. She was no match for his height or strength. He threw her to the ground. His eyes narrowed and his square jaw tightened. Mother scrambled to jump off the truck to Ona. It was too late. The commander pulled out a pistol and shot Ona in the head. I gasped, along with everyone else. Andrus grabbed Jonas's face and covered his eyes. Blood, the color of thick red wine, pooled under Ona's head. Her legs splayed out in an unnatural bent angle. One of her feet was missing a shoe. Lina, said Andrus. I turned my head to him, dazed. Don't look, he said. My mouth opened, but nothing came out. I turned my head back. The young blonde guard was staring at Ona's body. Lina, look at me, urged Andrus. Mother slumped on her knees near the edge of the truck, looking down at Ona. I moved and sat down near my brother. The engine rumbled and the truck began to roll. Mother sat down and put her face in her hands. Miss Grebus clucked her tongue, shaking her head. Jonas pulled my head against his knees and patted my hair.
Please, don't say anything to the guards. Don't make them mad, Lina, he whispered.
Ona's body got smaller and smaller as we drove away. She lay dead in the dirt, murdered by the NKVD. Somewhere, hundreds of miles away, her daughter decomposed in the grass. How would her family ever know what happened to her? How would anyone know what was happening to us? I would continue to write and draw whenever I had the chance. I would draw the commander firing, Mother on her knees with her head in her hands, and our truck driving away, the tires spitting gravel onto Ona's dead body. Chapter 28. We drove into a large collective farming area. Clusters of decrepit one-room cabins formed a shanty village. The warm sun was clearly temporary. Buildings pitched at a slant, their warped roofs warning of extreme weather. The guards ordered us off the truck. Andrus hung his head, standing close to his mother. They began directing us to what I thought were our own shacks. But when Miss Grebus and Mrs. Rimmis entered one, a woman ran out and began arguing with the guards.
There are people living in the cabins, whispered Jonas.
Yes, we'll most likely have to share, said Mother, pulling us close. Two women walked past us, carrying large buckets of water. I didn't recognize them from our train. We were assigned to a dingy hut near the back of the settlement. The gray wood was bald, shaved by many seasons of wind and snow. The door had splits and cracks and sat crooked on the frame. A strong wind could whisk the shack up into the sky, scattering it in a burst of pieces. The blonde guard pulled the door open, bellowed something in Russian, and pushed us inside. A squat Altaian woman, wrapped in layers, ran to the door and began screaming after the guard. Mother moved us to the corner. The woman turned and began yelling at us. Her hair poked out of her kerchief like black straw. Wrinkles formed an atlas on her wide, weathered face.
What's she saying? Asked Jonas.
She says she has no room for filthy criminals, says Mother.
We're not criminals, I said.
The woman continued her rant, throwing her arms in the air and spitting on the floor of the hut.
Is she crazy? Asked Jonas.
She says she barely has food enough for herself and she's not about to share it with criminals like us, Mother turned her back to the woman. Well now, we'll just set our things in the corner. Jonas, put your suitcase down. The woman grabbed my hair and pulled it, yanking me toward the door to throw me out. Mother yelled, blasting the woman in Russian. She ripped the woman's hand from my head, slapped her, and pushed her away. Jonas kicked her in the shin. The Altaian woman stared at us with angled black eyes. Mother returned the stare. The woman let out a hearty laugh. She asked a question. "We're Lithuanian," said Mother, first speaking in Lithuanian and then in Russian. The woman gibbered. "What's she saying?" I asked. "She says feisty people make good workers and that we have to pay her rent." Mother continued asking questions. "Pay her? For what? To live in this hole in the middle of nowhere?" I said. "We're in Altai," said Mother. "They are farming potatoes and beets."
"So there are potatoes to eat?" asked Jonas.
"Food is rationed. She said the guards oversee the farm and the workers," said Mother. I remembered Papa talking about Stalin confiscating peasants' land, tools, and animals. He told them what crops they would produce and how much they would be paid. I thought it was ridiculous. How could Stalin simply take something that didn't belong to him? Something that a farmer and his family had worked their whole lives for?
"That's communism, Lina," Papa had said.
The woman yelled at Mother, wagging her finger and shaking her head. She left the hut. We were on a kolkhoz, a collective farm, and I was to become a beet farmer. I hated beets. Part 2. Maps and Snakes. Chapter 29. The shack was approximately 10 feet by 12 feet. Lodged in the corner was a small stove surrounded by a couple of pots and dirty tins. A pallet of straw sat next to the wall near the stove. There was no pillow, only a worn quilted coverlet. Two tiny windows were created out of bits of glass that had been puttied together. "There's nothing here," I said. "There isn't a sink, a table, or a wardrobe." "Is that where she sleeps?" I asked.
"Where will we sleep? Where is the bathroom?"
"Where can we eat?" said Jonas. "I'm not certain," said Mother, looking in the pots. "This is filthy, but nothing a little cleaning can't fix, right?"
"Well, it's nice to be off that train," said Jonas.
The young blonde NKVD burst through the door.
"Elena Vilkis," he said.
Mother looked up at the guard.
"Elena Vilkis,"
he repeated, louder this time.
"Yes, that's me," said Mother.
They began speaking in Russian, then arguing.
"What is it, Mother?" asked Jonas.
Mother gathered us into her arms.
"Don't worry, love. We'll stay together."
The guard yelled, "Davai!" waving us out of the hut. "Where are we going?" I asked. "The commander wants to see me. I told him we all had to go together," said Mother. The commander. My stomach rolled. "I'll stay here. I'll be fine," I said.
"No, we must all stay together," said Jonas.
We followed the blonde guard between battered shacks until we reached a log building in much better condition than the others. A few NKVD gathered near the door smoking cigarettes. They leered at Mother. She surveyed the building and the guards.
"Stay here," she said. "I'll be right back."
"No," said Jonas. "We're coming in with you." Mother looked toward the lusty guards, then at me. A guard stepped down from the door.
"Davai!"
he yelled, pulling Mother by the elbow toward the building. "I'll be right back," said Mother over her shoulder, before she disappeared through the door.
"I'll be right back," said Mother.
"But what do you think?" I asked.
"I think you look lovely," said Mother, stepping back to admire the dress.
"Good," said the tailor, placing pins back into his small satin pincushion. "All done, Lina. You can change now. But be careful. It's just pinned, not stitched."
"Meet me on the sidewalk," said Mother over her shoulder before she disappeared through the door.
"Your mother has excellent taste in dresses," said the tailor. He was right.
The dress was beautiful. The soft gray color made my eyes stand out. I changed out of the dress and walked outside to meet Mother. She wasn't there. I peered down the row of brightly colored shops but didn't see her. Down the street, a door opened and Mother emerged. Her blue hat matched her dress, which fluttered around her legs as she walked toward me. She held up 2 ice cream cones and smiled, a shopping bag dangling from her arm. "The boys are having their day, and we'll have ours," said Mother, her red lipstick shining. She handed me a cone and steered us over to a bench. "Let's sit." Papa and Jonas had gone to a soccer match, and Mother and I had spent the morning shopping. I licked the creamy vanilla ice cream and leaned back against the warm bench. "It feels good to sit," sighed Mother. She looked over to me. "Okay, the dress is finished. What else did we have to do?" "I need charcoal," I reminded her. "Ah, that's right," said Mother. "Charcoal for my artist."
"We should have gone with her," said Jonas.
He was right. But I didn't want to be near the commander. Mother knew it. I should have gone in with her. Now she was alone with them, unprotected, and it was my fault. I tugged Jonas over to the side of the building near a dirty window.
"Stay here so the blonde guard can see you," I told Jonas. "What are you doing?" he said. "I'm going to look in the window to make sure Mother's all right." "No, Lina!"
"Stay there," I told him. The blonde guard looked no more than 20. He was the one who had turned away when we took our clothes off. He took out a pocket knife and began scraping underneath his fingernails. I edged over toward the window and stood on my toes. Mother sat in a chair and stared into her lap. The commander sat on the edge of a desk in front of her. He flipped through a file while speaking to Mother. He closed the file and balanced it on his thigh. I looked over at the guard, then stretched a bit higher for a better view.
"Stop it, Lina! Andris says they'll shoot us if you make trouble," whispered Jonas.
"I'm not making trouble," I said, moving back to my brother. "I just wanted to make sure she was all right."
"Well, remember what happened to Ona," said Jonas.
What had happened to Ona? Was she in heaven with her daughter and my grandma? Or was she floating amongst the trains and masses of Lithuanians searching for her husband? Those were questions for Papa. He always listened intently to my questions, nodding and then pausing carefully before answering. Who would answer my questions now? The weather was warm despite the cloudy sky. In the distance beyond the shacks, I saw spruce and pine trees interspersed with farmlands. I looked around, memorizing the landscape to draw it for Papa. I wondered where Andris and his mother were. Some of the buildings were in better shape than ours. One had a log fence around it, and another a small garden. I'd draw them, sad and shriveled, with barely a spot of color. The door to the building opened and Mother emerged. The commander walked out and leaned against the door frame, watching her walk. Mother's jaw clenched. She nodded as she came toward us. The commander called something to her from the door. She ignored him and grabbed our hands. "Take us back to the hut," she said, turning to the blonde guard. He didn't move.
"I know the way," said Jonas, starting off through the dirt. "Follow me."
"Are you okay?" I asked Mother once we began walking.
"I'm fine," she said, her voice low.
My shoulders dropped as weight escaped them.
"What did he want?"
"Not here," she said. Chapter 30. "They want me to work with them," said Mother, once Jonas had returned us to the shack.
"Work with them?" I said.
"Yes, well, they want me to work for them," she said, "translating documents and also speaking with the other Lithuanians who are here," she said. I thought of the file that the commander held.
"What will you get for doing it?" asked Jonas.
"I'm not going to be their translator," said Mother.
"I said no.
They also asked me to listen to people's conversations and report them to the commander.
To be a snitch? Said Jonas.
Yes, said Mother.
They want you to spy on everyone and report to them? I asked.
Mother nodded.
They promised preferential treatment if I agreed.
Pigs! I shrieked.
Lina, lower your voice, said Mother.
They think you would help them after what they've done to us? I said.
But Mother, maybe you will need the special treatment, said Jonas with concerned eyes.
They don't mean it, I snapped. They're all liars, Jonas. They wouldn't give her anything.
Jonas, said Mother, stroking my brother's face, I can't trust them. Stalin has told the NKVD that Lithuanians are the enemy. The commander and the guards look at us as beneath them. Do you understand?
Andris already told me that, said Jonas.
Andris is a very smart boy. We must speak only to one another, said Mother, turning to me. And please, Lina, be careful with anything you write or draw.
We dug through our suitcases and organized what we could sell if the need arose. I looked at my copy of the Pickwick Papers. Pages 6 through 11 were torn out. Page 12 had a smudge of dirt on it. I grasped the gold picture frame and took it out of the suitcase, staring at my father's face. I wondered where the handkerchief was. I had to send more.
Kostas, said Mother, looking over my shoulder.
I handed her the frame. Her index finger lovingly traced my father's face and then her mother's.
It's wonderful that you brought this. You have no idea how it lifts my spirit. Please keep it safe.
I opened the tablet of writing paper I had packed.
14 June 1941. Dear Joanna, stood alone on the first page. A title without a story.
I had written that nearly 2 months ago, the night we were taken.
Where was Joanna? And where were the rest of our relatives?
What would I write now if I were to finish it? Would I tell her that the Soviets had forced us into cattle cars and held us prisoner for 6 weeks with barely any food or water? Would I mention that they wanted Mother to spy for them?
And what about the baby that died in our car? And how the NKVD shot Ona in the head?
I heard Mother's voice warning me to be careful, but my hand began to move. Chapter 31. The Altaian woman returned and clattered around. She put a pot on the stove. We watched as she boiled 2 potatoes and gnawed on a stump of bread.
Mother, said Jonas, will there be potatoes for us tonight?
When we asked, we were told we had to work to earn food.
If you worked for the NKVD, Mother, would they give you food? Asked Jonas.
No, my dear. They would give me empty promises, she replied, which is worse than an empty belly. Mother paid the woman for a single potato, then again for the privilege to boil the potato. It was ridiculous.
How much money do we have left? I asked.
Barely any, she said. We tried to sleep, huddled against Mother on the floor of bare boards. The peasant woman slurped and snored, sunken in her bed of straw. Her sour breath filled the small room. Was she born here in Siberia? Had she ever known a life other than this? I stared into the dark and tried to paint images with my mind on the black canvas.
Open it, darling!
I can't. I'm too nervous, I told Mother.
She wanted to wait until you got home, Mother told Papa. She's been holding that envelope for hours. Open it, Lina, urged Jonas.
What if they didn't accept me? I said, my damp fingers clutching the envelope.
Well, then you'll be accepted next year, said Mother.
You won't know as long as the envelope is sealed, said Papa.
Open it, said Jonas, handing the letter opener to me.
I slid the silver blade under the flap on the back of the envelope. Ever since Mrs. Pronis had mailed my application, I had thought of little else. Studying with the best artists in Europe, it was such an opportunity. I sliced open the top of the envelope and removed a single sheet of folded paper. My eyes scanned quickly across the type. Dear Miss Vilkas, thank you for your recent application for the summer arts program. Your samples are most impressive. It is with great pleasure that we offer you a place in our... Yes! They said yes! I screamed.
I knew it, said Papa.
Congratulations, Lina, said Jonas, slinging his arm around me. I can't wait to tell Joanna, I said. That's wonderful, darling, said Mother. We have to celebrate. We have a cake, said Jonas.
Well, I was just certain we'd be celebrating, Mother winked.
Papa beamed.
You, my dear, are blessed with a gift, he said, taking my hands. There are great things in store for you, Lina.
I turned my head toward a rustling sound. The Altaian woman waddled to the corner, grunted, and peed into a tin can. Chapter 32. It was still dark when the NKVD began yelling. They ordered us out of the shack, shouting at us to form a line. We scrambled to fall in with the others. My Russian vocabulary was growing. In addition to Dvai, I had learned other important words such as Niet, which meant no, Svinya, which meant pig, and of course, Fascist, fascist. Miss Grebus and the grouchy woman were already in line. Mrs. Rimmis waved to Mother. I looked around for Andrus and his mother. They weren't there. Neither was the bald man. The commander walked up and down the line, chewing on his toothpick. He looked us over and made comments to the other guards.
What's he saying, Elena?
Asked Mrs. Rimmis. He's dividing us up for work detail, said Mother. The commander approached Mother and yelled in her face. He pulled Mother, Mrs. Rimmis, and the grouchy woman out of the line. The young blonde guard pulled me out of line and pushed me toward Mother. He divided up the rest. Jonas was in a group with two elderly women. Dvai! The young blonde guard handed Mother a belted piece of canvas and marched our group away. Meet us back at the shack, yelled Mother to Jonas. How would that be possible? Mother and I couldn't even find our way back from the NKVD building. It was Jonas who showed us the way. We would surely be lost. My stomach turned with hunger. My legs dragged. Mother and Mrs. Rimmis whispered back and forth in Lithuanian behind the blonde guard. After walking a few kilometers, we arrived at a clearing in the woods. The guard grabbed the canvas from Mother and threw it on the ground. He yelled a command.
He says, dig, said Mother.
Dig?
Dig where?
Asked Mrs. Rimmis.
Here, I guess, said Mother. He says if we want to eat, we must dig. Our ration depends on our progress.
What are we to dig with? I asked. Mother asked the blonde guard. He kicked the heap of canvas. Mother unfolded it and found several rusty hand shovels, the kind used in a flower garden. The handles were missing. Mother said something to the guard that prompted an irate Dvai and the kicking of the shovels into our shins.
Get out of my way, said the grouchy woman. I'm going to get this over with. I need to eat and so do my girls.
She got down on her hands and knees and started chipping away at the earth with a tiny shovel. We all followed. The guard sat under a tree and watched, smoking cigarettes.
Where are the potatoes and the beets? I asked Mother.
Well, they are clearly punishing me, said Mother.
Punishing you? Asked Mrs. Rimmis.
Mother whispered in her ear about the commander's offer to work for him.
But Elena... You could have gotten preferential treatment, said Mrs. Rimmis, and most likely extra food.
A guilty conscience is not worth extra food, said Mother. Think of the demands that could be made of me in that office, and think of what could happen to people. I don't need that on my soul. I'll persevere like everyone else.
A woman said there's a town 5 kilometers away. There's a store, a post office, and a school, said Mrs. Rimmis.
Perhaps we could walk there, said Mother,
and send letters. Maybe someone has heard from the men.
Be careful, Elena. Sending letters may endanger the people back home, said Mrs. Remus. Don't put anything in writing ever. I looked at my feet. I had been writing down everything and had already filled several pages with descriptions and drawings.
No,
whispered Mother. She looked to the grouchy woman pounding the dirt and leaned toward Mrs. Remus. I have a contact. What did Mother mean, she had a contact? Who was her contact? And the war. Now the Germans were in Lithuania. What was Hitler doing? I wondered what had happened to our house and everything we left behind. And why were we digging this stupid hole? Well, at least your housemate talks to you, said Mother. Ours is a beastly thing that grabbed Lina by the hair. The villagers are not happy, said Mrs. Remus. But they were expecting us. Apparently, several truckloads of Estonians were dumped in a nearby village a few days ago. Mother's shovel paused. Estonians? Yes, whispered Mrs. Remus. They've deported people from Estonia and Latvia, too. Mother sighed. I feared that might happen. It's madness. How many will they deport? Elena, there will be hundreds of thousands, said Mrs. Remus.
Quit your gossiping and get to work, barked the grouchy woman. I want to eat.
Chapter 33. We had dug a pit more than 2 feet deep when a truck brought a small bucket of water. The guard gave us a break. Blisters wept on my hands. Our fingers were caked with dirt. They wouldn't give us a ladle or a cup. We bent like dogs, each taking turns, lapping out of the bucket, while the blonde guard drank leisurely from a large canteen. The water smelled fishy, but I didn't care. My knees looked like raw meat, and my back ached from bending for hours. We were digging in a small clearing surrounded by woods. Mother asked permission to go to the bathroom and then pulled me, along with Mrs. Remus, into the trees. We squatted, our dresses bunched around our waists to relieve ourselves. We faced each other all on our haunches. Elena, can you pass the talcum, please? Said Miss Remus, wiping herself with a leaf. We began to laugh. It was such a ridiculous sight, grabbing our knees in a circle, we actually laughed. Mother laughed so hard that her ringlets fell loose from the kerchief she had tied around her hair. Our sense of humor, said Mother, her eyes pooled with laughing tears. They can't take that away from us, right? We roared with laughter. The lantern flames flickered in the dark. Joanna's brother pumped a playful tune on the accordion. My uncle, who had indulged in blackberry liqueur, danced a disjointed jig around the backyard of the cottage, trying to imitate our mother's. He pretended to hold a skirt and looped from side to side.
Come, whispered Joanna, grabbing my hand. Let's take a walk.
We locked arms and walked between the dark cottages down to the beach. Sand crawled into my shoes. We stood on the shore, the water lapping near our feet. The Baltic Sea glistened in the moonlight. The way the moon is shining on the water, it's like it's beckoning us in, sighed Joanna. It is. It's calling us, I said, memorizing the light and shadows to paint later. I kicked off my sandals. Let's go. I don't have my bathing suit, said Joanna. Neither do I. So what? So what? Lina, we can't swim naked, she said. Who said anything about swimming naked? I asked. I waded into the black water in my dress. Lina, for goodness sake, what are you doing? Gasped Joanna. I held out my arms and traced the moon's shadows on the water. My skirt lifted, weightless. Come on, it's lovely. I dived under the surface. Joanna kicked off her shoes and waded into the water up to her ankles. The light reflected off her long brown hair and tall frame. Come in, it's beautiful, I said. She waded in slowly, too slowly. I jumped up and pulled her in. She screamed and laughed.
Joanna's laugh could be singled out in a crowd. It had a raw freedom that echoed around me. "You're crazy," she said. "Why am I crazy? It looked so beautiful. I wanted to be part of it," I said. "Will you paint us like this?" asked Joanna. "Yes, I'll call it Two Heads Bobbing in Black," I said, flicking water at her. "I don't want to go home. It's just too perfect here," she said, swirling her arms through the water. "Shh, someone's coming." "Where?" I said, spinning around. "There, in the trees," she whispered. Two figures emerged from the trees in front of the beach. "Lina, it's him. The tall one, the one I told you about. The one I saw in town. What do we do?" Two boys walked to shore looking out at us.
"A bit late for a swim, isn't it?" said the tall boy.
"Not at all," I said.
"Oh, really? Do you always go swimming after dark?" he asked.
"I go swimming whenever I feel like it," I said.
"And what about your older sister there? Does she always go swimming at night?"
"Why don't you ask her yourself?" I said.
Joanna kicked me underwater. "You should be careful. You don't want someone to see you without clothes," he grinned.
"Really? You mean like this?"
I jumped and stood up in the water. My wet dress clung to me like melted taffy to paper. I flung my arm in the water, trying to get them both wet. "Crazy kid," he laughed, dodging the water. "Come on," said his friend. "We'll be late for the meeting."
"A meeting? What sort of meeting is going on at this hour?" I asked. The boys dropped their heads for a moment.
"We have to go." "Goodbye, older sister," said the tall boy to Joanna before turning to walk down the beach with his friend.
"Bye," said Joanna.
We laughed so hard I thought surely our parents would hear us.
We jumped out of the water, grabbed our sandals, and ran back through the sand onto the shadowy path. Frogs and crickets chirped and warbled all around us. Joanna grabbed my arm, pulling me to a stop in the dark. "Don't tell our parents."
"Joanna, we're soaking wet. They'll know we went swimming," I said.
"No, I mean about the boys and what they said," she said.
"All right, older sister. I won't tell," I said, grinning. We ran through the dark, laughing all the way back to the cottage.
What did Joanna know about the boys and their meeting that I didn't?
The laughter had died.
"Lina, let's go, dear," said Mother.
I looked back to the hole. What if we were digging our own grave?
Chapter 34. I found a stick and snapped it in half. I sat down and used it to draw in a patch of hard dirt. I drew our house, garden, and the trees before it was time to return to work. I pushed small stones into the earth with my thumb, creating a pathway to our front door, and lined the roof with twigs. "We must prepare," said Mother. "The winter will be beyond anything we've experienced. Temperatures will be below freezing. There will be no food."
"Winter?" I said, leaning back on my heels. "Are you joking? You think we'll still be here when winter comes? Mother, no!"
Winter was months away. I couldn't bear the thought of living in that shack, digging holes for months and trying to avoid the commander. I glanced over to the blonde guard. He was looking at my drawing in the dirt.
"I hope not," said Mother, lowering her voice. "But what if we are? If we're not prepared, we'll surely freeze or starve."
Mother had the grouchy woman's attention.
"The snowstorms in Siberia are treacherous," said Mrs. Rimmis, nodding.
"I don't know how the shacks withstand it," said Mother.
"Why don't we build our own building?" I asked.
"We can build a log house like the Kolkhoz office, with a chimney and a stove. We can all live together."
"Stupid girl. They'll never give us time to build something of our own. And if we did build something, they'd take it for themselves," said the grouchy woman. "Keep digging."
It began to rain. Water plopped on our heads and shoulders. We opened our mouths to drink. This is insanity, said Mrs. Rimmis. Mother shouted over to the blonde guard. The butt of his cigarette glowed under the shelter of the tree branches. He says we must dig faster, said Mother, raising her voice as the rain poured down in sheets, that the soil will be soft now. Bastard, said Mrs. Rimmis. I looked over and saw our house melting in the dirt. My drawing stick rolled away, propelled by the wind and rain. I put my head down and dug. I jabbed the small shovel into the earth, harder and harder, pretending the soil was the commander. My fingers cramped and my arms shook with exhaustion. The hem of my dress was ripped and my face and neck were sunburned from the morning sun. When the rain stopped, we marched back to the camp covered in mud up to our waists. My stomach convulsed with hunger. Mrs. Rimmis slung the canvas over her shoulder and we dragged along, our hands cramped, still locked onto the shovel blades we had gripped for nearly 12 hours. We entered the camp near the back. I recognized the bald man's shack with its brown door and was able to direct Mother toward ours. Jonas was inside waiting for us. Every pot was brimming with water. You're back, he shouted. I was worried you wouldn't find the hut. Mother wrapped her arms around Jonas, kissing his hair. It was still raining when I got back, explained Jonas. I dragged the pots outside so we could have water. Very smart, love. Have you had some to drink? Asked Mother. Plenty, he said, looking at me in my bedraggled state. You can have a nice bath. We drank from a large pot before washing our legs off. Mother insisted I drink more, even when I felt I couldn't. Jonas sat cross-legged on the boards. One of Mother's scarves was spread out in front of him. In the center was a lonely piece of bread with a small flower next to it. Mother looked down at the bread and the wilted flower. What sort of banquet do we have here? She said. I received a ration coupon for my work today. I worked with 2 ladies making shoes, said Jonas, smiling. Are you hungry? You look tired. I'm so hungry, I said, staring at the solitary piece of bread. If Jonas received bread for working indoors on shoes, we must certainly be getting an entire turkey, I thought. We are each entitled to 300 grams of bread for our work, explained Jonas. You have to collect your ration coupon at the Kolkhoz office. That's all? Asked Mother. Jonas nodded. 300 grams of dry bread. I couldn't believe it. That's all we got after digging for hours. They were starving us and would probably dump us into the holes we dug. It's not enough, I said. We'll find something more, said Mother. Fortunately, the commander wasn't at the log building when we arrived. We were given our coupons without having to beg or dance. We followed the other workers into a nearby building. The bread was weighed and distributed to us. I could almost close my palm around the entire ration. On the way back, we saw Miss Grebus in back of her shack. She waved us over. Her arms and dress were filthy. She had been working in the beet fields all day. Her face twisted